Earlier this week, we explored two questions. Is the country ready to elect a black president? And is the country ready to elect a woman to that office?
Well, those segments brought in a flood of response, so we'll begin our letter segment with some today.
Jeff Blakely of Palm Beach, California, couldn't believe his ears. He writes, I have never been so moved to respond to a story. Michelle said that she had heard grumblings from black staffers and politicians that Senator Barack Obama wasn't black enough. After hearing that, I started talking to myself out loud. The utter offensiveness, absurdity, and irrelevance of such a presidential qualification, real or imagined, can't be overstated. Do we ask white candidates if they are white enough? How silly.
Michael A.D. Reed of Atlanta, Georgia, was moved by that same story and this comment in particular, made by author Diane McWhorter.
To me, the primitive fear of white people is that if you have an African American as the leader of the free world, that they're going to give away white privilege, you know, that we are going to have to give up something that we have taken for granted.
Michael Reed writes that after hearing that, my interest in your interviews gradually turned to irritation and then anger. He continues, white Americans' perceptions about black Americans do, undeniably and unfortunately, encompass fear. But our relationship to African Americans is so much more complex than simply black equals scary. It also includes guilt and anger and envy and admiration. McWhorter hinted at that when she recounted her interview with the Alabama Klansman, who didn't want to lose his black supervisor's respect. The appeal of Senator Obama and Secretary Colin Powell to white Americans is precisely that they know that in this country, black and white covers an awful lot of gray.
Our colleague Robert Siegel looked into possible worst-case scenarios in Iraq with a number of foreign policy experts, and that caught the ear of Judy Rittenhouse of Allentown, Pennsylvania. She writes, it was a relief to hear NPR cast about for more informed, even pessimistic analysis of what the Iraqis might expect. It's a fatal loss to us all that we didn't hear more probing along these lines 4 years ago.
On now to response to my interview with Father Jim Miller of St. Mary Catholic Church in Marshalltown, Iowa. He's offering assistance to the families of about 90 local meatpacking workers detained in last week's federal immigration raids.
A number of you wrote to answer Father Miller's question, what would Jesus do? Kelly Fulks of Harvest, Alabama, is among those who has an answer, and he writes, it would seem that we should obey civil laws in order to be right in the sight of God. Thus, to help these people in a spiritual manner, we must get them in subjection to the laws. This means that they must leave this country that they have entered illegally if they are truly here illegally. I hope that Father Miller remembers this as he helps these people.
Major Stephen Fetro was unhappy with our coverage of a pilot mental health program in the California National Guard, where he serves as the head of mental health. The Guard is embedding mental health workers with units after they return from serving in Iraq.
Major Fetro writes, the California National Guard is likely the most proactive and aggressive when it comes to mental health issues. The embedded mental health program is just one program among a host of others. He continues taking issue with the soldiers' comments we used in our piece. These two soldiers are not indicative of the general feeling in the field. The comments that the program is a waste of time and that the providers are intrusive is an absolute slap in the face of our 37 providers working hard to assist our soldiers. And he points out that 904 soldiers have taken part in the program so far.
Finally, a few comments on a matter that many pregnant women face, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD. This is a type of genetic testing performed on an embryo to help determine if debilitating or even fatal diseases are likely to develop.
Mark Jacobson of Boca Raton, Florida writes, I found your story absolutely fascinating, and I couldn't help but wonder whether this is just one more example of how people with money have access to certain advantages than people who do not. Rich people have been able to buy better health care for a long time. PGD just seems to be an extension of that.
Kristen McGrory of Wilmington, Delaware, went through PGD herself, and she writes that she was deeply disappointed with our stories. She writes, while I realize the aim of your story was to illustrate the potential ethical dilemmas raised by PGD, I'm concerned that your coverage has left your listeners with the wrong impression. In particular, I was disappointed that you failed to mention the potential of PGD for couples struggling with infertility, particularly recurrent miscarriages. That was our situation. My husband and I are certainly not looking to have the perfect child, nor are we a spoiled couple looking to avoid the demands of an unhealthy child. We are a couple who wish to have a child, period.
We'd like you to write to us. Go to npr.org and click on Contact Us at the top of the page.